You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls. W228 Eau Claire.
CBS News and streaming everywhere on the Civic
presented
Media
by Indeed.com.
I'm Tom Foti in Washington. President Biden's visiting a country with which the U.S. was at war for a decade, a half century ago. But now Vietnam's among Asian nations somewhat at odds with the more assertive giant next door, China. Still, Mr. Biden says his visit to Vietnam is not about containing China.
We have an opportunity to strengthen alliances around the world to maintain stability. That's what this trip was all about.
By means of new economic cooperation with Vietnam. Speaking there, Mr. Biden also expressed sorrow and sympathy for Morocco after the recent 6.8 earthquake there. It is now blamed for at least 2,100 deaths.
This is suffering, one resident says. To enter the ancient city and witness the collapsed homes and see people in great pain, it's a painful experience. Another resident whose house is still standing says he fears it's too damaged to be safe. I returned to my house and noticed many cracks in the walls, he says. I can't sleep there.
CBS's Haley Ott. Now, Mr. Biden and his re-election hopes at age 80.
53% of Americans think the job of president is too demanding for someone over the age of 75. And both Republicans and Democrats agree on this.
CBS News survey manager Fred Backus. Convicted killer Danilo Cavalcante still on the loose near Philadelphia, but apparently looking different, clean-shaven, wearing a hooded sweatshirt, black baseball cap, and white shoes.
News of Cavalcante's sighting put residents like Bob Strait on edge.
Just making sure the doors are locked. Every time I leave, making sure the garage doors are closed, the cars are locked.
Officials say Cavalcante is believed to be driving a white Ford Transit van he stole from Bailey's Dairy. They say he shaved his face, but is still wearing his green prison pants.
KYW radio reporter Justin Udo. Hurricane Lee has weakened, but is still a strong Atlantic storm with potential problems along the U.S. East Coast, even if it never comes close to shore.
It is still going to cause a couple of problems for the United States that everybody needs to be aware of. Large waves and dangerous rip currents. And that's going to happen certainly as the week goes on and the storm gets closer. Could also see a little bit of coastal flooding depending where it comes.
CBS News meteorologist David Parkinson on the Health Watch 3 years after the height of the coronavirus pandemic.
If you're like a lot of people, you may have old COVID kits stashed away from earlier infectious days. But health officials say it's important to check to make sure they're not expired. If they are, you can't trust the results. Extreme heat can also affect outcomes. At-home tests also work best when you use them in an environment that's between about 59 and 86 degrees Fahrenheit.
That is CBS News correspondent Deborah Rodriguez, and this is CBS News.
When you think of hiring, think of Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Moments like
Civic Media radio stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Most older adults are not prepared to respond quickly in the event of natural disasters like wildfires or flash floods that can strike with little notice. Mike Moan reports now on steps Wisconsin seniors can take.
Fewer than one in three adults age 50 and older have created an emergency plan for wildfires, flooding, tornadoes, summer heat domes, or winter bomb cyclones. The findings were issued by AARP and the University of Chicago. Tom Camber with AARP says the first step is to ensure having access to vital information.
Getting signed up for alerts, as we all saw with the recent fires in Hawaii, just a few minutes was the difference in life and death.
Camber recommends having a phone charger for your car, making sure emergency contacts are listed in your smartphone, and creating copies of important documents that you can access online. AARP offers a template for creating an emergency plan and links to resources, and Wisconsin Emergency Management has a list of preparedness tips for seniors on its website. Those in assisted living facilities and their family members should talk with administrators about their emergency and evacuation plans. Camber says it's critical to discuss your needs with a trusted support network before a disaster occurs.
But it also sets up questions around, for example, who's going to be your in-case-of-emergency contact in your phone? If you do have to relocate in an emergency, is there somebody who you've already identified where you can go and stay?
It's also important to have 3 days' supply of food and water and 3 weeks' supply of prescription medicines on hand and ready to go. Older adults are frequently more socially isolated, so Camber says it's especially important for neighbors to look out for each other during a crisis. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Hey, son. How are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
Everybody, welcome to the Cripes Cast. I'm your host, Charlie Behrens. This is the podcast where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest. We are brought to you by Jolly Good Soda. Hello, folks. Welcome to a very special episode of the Cripes Cast. This is our second live episode ever. We shot this episode at the Terrace at UW-Madison, the Wisconsin Union Terrace. It was super fun. It was a panel, actually, with Dan Egan, who is a return guest. He is, of course, the author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. He also has a new book out called The Devil's Element, Phosphorus, and A World Out of Balance. And his book is all about phosphorus. Phosphorus is something that we all create. It's in our waste. You do the math on that one. It's something that it's sort of the building, one of the building blocks of life. We could not have life without it. But when we mine it and we use it in certain ways, it winds up in our waterways and screws some things up. So anyway, that's sort of what this conversation is about. We also had two other experts join us from UW-Madison. We had Jake Van Der Zanden. He is an expert of freshwater lakes and the director of UW-Madison Center for Limnology, and also Randy Jackson from the Department of Agronomy at UW-Madison. And he's kind of talking about sort of successful agricultural systems. I introduce them all in the longer version, so you can kind of get that vibe out there. But I just sort of wanted to say this up top. Part of this conversation involves farmers, and it involves farming practices. And just off the top, I want to say that I've got so much respect for our farmers, and the farmers are already implementing a lot of the things that need to limit phosphorus in our waterways. Fertilizing practices. They're already I was talking to a few of my buddies who are farmers, before this conversation specifically, and sort of where they're coming from on this is they're already dealing with a lot of regulations. They're not making a whole lot of money. So the idea of putting more regulations in is a very difficult thing. And also, you know, they know the land, and they're no farmer is out there trying to waste any fertilizer, which is where phosphorus comes from and how it gets into our waterways. So all farmers out there are trying to do the right thing. This really has nothing to do with current farmers and how they're practicing. Rather, it's sort of the system, and how do we look at this system that, frankly, our politics have set up, and say, do we still want this? You know, is this kind of what we as a society still want? And that's us as people, farmers as farmers, do we want it? Is there a better system, more of a win-win system, where farmers can be more profitable and where the environment can be better? You know, and I think we have a couple creative solutions that we discuss in this, but it's really important to me at the top of this that we just reiterate that this is not a knock on farmers. Farmers are sort of acting within the system and the rules that are put in place by our public policy and by our politics. And honestly, that's where the problem lies. It's not with the farmers, it's with the politics and the system that the rest of us had put in place. And on top of that, all of us eat food, all of us create waste. So we are all contributing to phosphorus in our water systems. And it's not just farming. It's also the fertilizer we put on our gardens, the fertilizer we put on golf courses, waste treatment facilities, which could often do a better job of treating that waste, and industry. So there's several different sources of phosphorus. Agriculture happens to be a major source. So that's kind of the focus of this podcast. But I just off the top, I just want to make it clear that that this is a group effort, and we're all just trying to find a win-win for this situation. So with that, I'm joined off the top here by Colleen Maraca, EP of the Cripescast. Colleen, you did a great job setting up and producing this live deal. And by the way, we packed the terrace somehow.
Yeah, without beer.
Without beer. They weren't serving beer, I think, because it was move-in week.
Yeah.
And they always pretend like, yeah, we don't drink here.
Yeah. So, you know? I think it was like they didn't want to supply the kids, or people were like, they don't want parents. They're like, it would be set up parents in uncomfortable situation to see their kids drink. And I'm like, well, newsflash. They're going to one of the top party schools in the nation. So,
yeah. Well, I get it. It's a nice thought.
It's holding up the illusion for the last week before their kid leaves them. So, anyway, it was good though. Someone brought you hams, which was really sweet.
It was nice. Yeah.
But it was when I was like preparing stuff for this, when they had Randy Jackson, I thought of like American Idol.
I know. Yeah.
Like, wouldn't it be funny if like you have all these like scientists and then like Randy Jackson's there? He's like, it's no for me, dog. So yeah, I was laughing.
I'm sure Randy gets that all the time.
Yeah. So I thought that was funny, but they did a really good job and it was fun to be back on the terrace.
Yep. UW-Madison alum, Colleen Maraca.
Back at you.
Back at, yep. Yep.
But yeah, it was really nice to be back and it was so pretty out and perfect day for it worked out well.
Awesome. All right, folks. Well, without further ado, here's my conversation with Dan Egan, Jake VanderZanden, and Randy Jackson on the Wisconsin Union Terrace. And we are talking about phosphorus. Folks, I want to welcome you all to this live taping of the Cripescast podcast. The Cripescast is my podcast. That's the tagline. So we got that going here today. And today we are talking about phosphorus and its impacts on our lakes here in Wisconsin, what some of the culprits could be and what we can all do about it collectively. So I want to first introduce our panel. To my left is Dan Egan. He is an author. Pulitzer Prize runner-up twice. Is that the deal, Dan? Loser twice. Pulitzer Prize losing author twice in a row. There you go. But he wrote The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. It's a New York Times bestseller. And his latest book, The Devil's Element, is all about phosphorus and a world out of balance. So I'll give Dan one more round of applause. And then next to Dan, we got Randy Jackson. He's from the Department of Agronomy, at UW-Madison. He's going to be explaining about agricultural systems, how they can be successful, how some of them are currently not successful. And did I say agronomy right or no?
You said agronomy right, but we just renamed ourselves Plant and Agroecosystem Sciences. It really rolls off the tongue.
That's a sexier name. Yeah. Yeah, agronomy, I was going to tell you. I was like, that don't look good on a shirt. But when you take the whole shirt up describing it, now we're cooking with gas.
Half shirt is never here.
Yeah. And Randy, you're wearing a shirt called Grassland. What's that all about?
Grassland 2.0. That's the idea that one way or another, eventually, we have to have agricultural systems that more closely resemble and mimic the ecosystem functions of the original prairie.
All right. Randy Jackson, folks. He's your grass man, okay? And no, I don't mean it like that. I see that Grateful Dead shirt back there. And now all the way over at the left, we've got Jake VanderZanden. He's an expert. Yeah, let's hear it for me. He's an expert of freshwater lakes and the director of UW-Madison Center for Limnology. What in the hell is limnology?
I hear that question all the time. Limnology is the study of inland waters. So lakes, but also rivers, wetlands, Inland Water Systems.
Inland Water Systems. Okay. Also would look good on a shirt. I like that. All right. So I want to start off this conversation by talking with Dan and have him sort of set the stage here. Dan, your latest book, The Devil's Element, is all about phosphorus. For everybody out there who either doesn't know or doesn't care what phosphorus is, what is it and why should they care?
Well, it's the fertilizer that puts food on our table, and it's existed in the environment forever. But in the last 100, 120 years, we figured out how to turn a slow trickle of this essential nutrient into a gusher. And we do that by mining rocks in various caches around the world. And it's allowed the population on Earth to go from about 1 billion to some 9 billion and heading for more. Without phosphorus, we couldn't do it. The problem is there are finite resources, finite supplies of these rocks, and we're also burning through it at such a pace that it's getting into the water. And when it gets into the water, it's not going to grow a kernel of corn or a soybean. It's going to grow algae, and too often that's toxic algae. And that's why too often there are days here where the lake looks beautiful out in the middle, but there's a green goop along the shoreline, and it is not just unsightly and unpleasant, it's downright dangerous to be in.
Well, and let's talk about now sort of like, why is it dangerous? Can the limnology department tell us about why is it so dangerous to be in that goop?
Yeah, absolutely. The phosphorus, as we mentioned, comes in from the surrounding lands. And as Dan mentioned, it fuels blooms of algae. It also fuels blooms of something called cyanobacteria, and those produce toxins. And these toxins are harmful to people, wildlife. They can cause death. A wide range of health conditions derive from this. So it's really bad. It's also unhealthy for the lake. So the lake turns green. We lose biodiversity. The lakes become anoxic. There's no oxygen left, which basically makes them uninhabitable to life. So it has really bad impacts on lakes and on the people that are surrounding and using the lakes.
And so, like, if you were golfing, like I used to be a caddy and I would look at the ponds in the middle of the golf course because I'd be like, oh, I wonder if they got any bass in there, you know? And then the guy I was caddying for would be like, where's my iron? I'd be like, I'm anemic. I lose all your irons. And so funny, Charlie. Really good joke. That was hilarious. Way to slide that one in there. So, but when you're on a golf course, oftentimes you see these ponds that are just nothing but sludge unless they have the money to just dye them blue. Is that what we're talking about?
Do not swim in them. And I think that
why not?
Because they have toxic blue green algae in them, and you can get really sick.
I wasn't there a case back in the early 90s where a kid went swimming in a golf course pond in Dane County?
2002, a kid was swimming in a golf course pond in Madison, and he died. And the autopsy indicated that blue green algae poisoning was the likely culprit. So people die of this.
Very interesting. And by interesting, I mean tragic. But also there is a kind of a funny story that you start your book off with, Dan. Tell people about that story real quick.
Funny for us, I guess, not for the guy that it happened to. But yeah, there was a guy down in Cape Coral, Florida. He was being chased by the police and he ditched his car. He had drugs in the car. And went for it on foot and jumped into a canal. And he jumped into a canal that was just covered in this goop. And he started to drown. I mean, the cops would not go in to get him. They were trying to get him a lifeline. They were trying to call radio for a raft. And he ended up dog paddling his way back. And they pulled him onto a backyard. And this is all on body cam. You know, you can watch it. You can go to YouTube and watch this poor guy.
It was a viral video, folks. Everyone's like, this dumb criminal got caught for drugs and then almost drowned himself. But
he jumped into toxic goo. And, you know, it's not just swimming. If you're close to this stuff, it aerosolizes. And there's some concerns that it's causing or could be a potentially one factor in the trigger for some neurological diseases like ALS. So that's... we'll stick away from that for right now, but you don't want toxic blue-green algae in your lake or in your neighborhood. You don't want it anywhere.
And now that we've kind of defined what the problem is and how phosphorus, you know, sort of perpetuates it, I want to turn over to Randy and ask him about sort of the agricultural systems in play that are kind of promoting this. And by the way, I do want to say at the offset, a ton of my family and friends are farmers, and farming is one source of phosphorus. We are all a source of phosphorus, you know, after you have a few too many beers and, you know, you got to go drain the jerky, as my grandpa used to say. Good, Charlie. Really good. Way to bring your grandpa's best quote into this thing. But we're all sources of it. And there are several industrial sources, but agriculture is another very big source of that. So, Randy, could you kind of elaborate on those systems?
Yeah, sure. So our agricultural system is set up to basically extract and squeeze as much as we can out of the land. And that is no fault of any farmer. The farmers are doing what the system is set up to do. And they're responding to the signals that society is sending them, which is like, make as much as you can, make as much as you can. And so there is this just incessant push to keep producing more and more and more. And as a result, the system is inherently leaky. We squeeze a lot of nutrients out of it. It's not just phosphorus, it's nitrogen. We lose carbon to the atmosphere and help drive climate change. And so the harder we push those ecosystems, the harder we push the agricultural system, the more leaky it's going to be of those nutrients. And so we have to, this whole notion of Grassland 2.0 is we have to find a way as society to signal to farmers, can we expect a little bit less out of the land and reward you for that and take care of you, the farmer, for taking care of us?
Yeah. You could clap for that. There you go. So right now, kind of my understanding of the system we had set up. Sorry, Dan, you were about to, you did the ice cream cone with your mic. Did you have something to say there? Oh, you were itching your ear. Okay, false start on that. The system that we currently have in place, and you know, maybe this is just general knowledge of how I see it, is basically we have our politicians, we have big conglomerate farming corporations, and they call it lobbying, but I think most people just see it as bribing politicians into doing things their way. Was that cynical, Charlie? Come on, say no. But you
promised you weren't going to get me in trouble.
I'm not getting you in trouble, but you do have these bigger corporations that are invested in seeing something done one way, and they kind of push politicians on sort of the national and various local levels to do so. Is that accurate, or is it more nuanced than that? It's definitely more nuanced.
It's accurate, you know, and more nuanced than that. It's accurate in that we desperately need policies that will help shape this kind of agriculture that I talked about a minute ago. And it's almost impossible to get those kind of policies enacted, especially at the federal level. There's heroic efforts at the state level and even at the local level and the county level, et cetera, to push us to get more of those types of policies in place. But of course, whenever you're poking at the bear being the corporations that are actually making money from the current system, it's a hard thing to push and a hard thing to change. So
I guess, how is the system set up right now where it's promoting more phosphorus? What are the crops that are subsidized, and should they be, in your opinion?
Well, there are seven commodity crops that are subsidized by the federal government, and here in this part of the world, corn and soybeans. Wheat are some of the crops that get subsidies from the federal government. And the point of the subsidies is to keep those systems profitable, even when they're not really profitable. And so if we were to take some of those subsidies and put them towards something like grassland that actually holds on to phosphorus, that actually holds on to carbon, that actually helps promote biodiversity, we'd be in a lot better position. But there are a lot of vested interests and powerful interests that don't want that to happen. And those are mainly corporations. And again, these are the corporations reacting rationally. They're doing what they're supposed to do, which is maximize profits for their shareholders. So they're not nefarious actors. They're just responding to the system that we've set up. And we have to come together as a people and figure out how to change the system so that it's better for all of us.
Dan, in doing your book, you've seen sort of a similar thing at play back in the 70s with detergent and how that had a lot of phosphorus in it, and it was a really bad deal, and somehow we turned the tables on it. Can you kind of give us a quick story about that?
Sure. Yeah. And we turned the tables on it with science, which is, you know, it's got to drive everything. And one of the reasons when we were talking about doing this, we were talking about doing it on the terrace by Lake Mendota, which is having algae troubles for many years now. And we have some of the smartest people who can address these problems. Two of them are up here right now, right here on this campus. It's the Wisconsin idea. Take the stuff out of the classroom and put it into the environment and into communities and better people's lives. And that's exactly what happened in the 1970s. The lakes were going to heck all across the country. None was in worse shape than Lake Erie, which they were calling America's Dead Sea at the time. And it was just, it was covered with literally hundreds of square miles of goop. Nobody knew what was going on. What was driving it? Was it industrial pollutants? Was it nitrogen? Was it phosphorus? Was it carbon? So some scientists went up to far northwestern Ontario, and this is remarkable. They set aside a cluster of lakes and started treating them like test tubes. They were given carte blanche to basically poison these lakes to see what would make them turn green. It was like test tubes on a lake scale. And through dumping various inputs into these lakes, they determined, well, the most dramatic experiment they did was they took one lake, named Lake 226. And they
good cut name it, for the lake.
Yeah,
by
they
the
had
way.
So many lakes they couldn't even name them. They just gave them numbers. Anyway, they cut this one in half with a polyurethane curtain. And in simple terms, they gave one side phosphorus and one side nitrogen. Well, both anyway, one side got phosphorus. That side turned green as a golf course in a matter of 2 weeks. Guys went up in a helicopter, took pictures of that, took that to state legislatures and said, you know how you're killing Lake Erie? It's phosphorus. And at this point, it wasn't phosphorus from agriculture. It was phosphorus in our detergents. The detergent companies didn't like this at all, but they were called to account. And we ended up pulling phosphorus out of the detergent formulas. And so in 1972, Dr. Seuss was writing about Lake Erie and the Lorax, and he was making fun of it. I don't remember his exact line, but by 1985, the lake had recovered so dramatically that some researchers at Ohio State wrote the good doctor, Theodore Geisel, and said, you should pull that from the Lorax. And he did. Now he should put it back. He's dead. But Lake Erie's a mess again, and it's phosphorus again. This time it's not coming from a very specific waste stream. It's coming off the landscape. And yeah.
Yeah, and it's not just coming from agriculture. What are the other sources of phosphorus in the lakes?
Yeah, okay. So phosphorus can come from different sources. Urban runoff is a big one. Not as big as agriculture for the Lake Mendota watershed, but urban runoff. So the water that runs off of the streets, off of parking lots, it goes directly into storm sewers. And then it goes right to the lake. So it's important for you all to know that that water that runs off is not treated. It goes directly to the lake. There's phosphorus that comes off, also oils and metals and all sorts of other pollutants. But again, we want to focus on phosphorus here. Another is sewage treatment plant effluents. That's not a huge source in the grand scheme of things, but there's no sewage treatment plant effluent going into Lake Mendota, but it is a source of phosphorus generally into waterways. And then there are other industrial sources as well, factories and so on. Those are generally minor. So the Clean Water Act from 1972 addressed these pipe sources quite nicely. So the amount of phosphorus coming from pipes has gone down a lot. And now what we're left with is agricultural and urban runoff from the landscape. So that, you know, the situation has changed, but it also does tell us that there have been problems in the past that have been largely solved, like the detergent problem, like the point source problem.
And in the example of the detergent problem, basically you had these three big detergent makers, right? Tide and two others. I don't do laundry much, so, you know, I usually just let it sit until it can't sit anymore, and then there we go.
I need to call a timeout here. I got a hand for you, Charlie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, where did this come from? See, Adam, I knew one of you guys were sneaking it in here.
Adam went back to the Center for Limnology and grabbed a beer for you.
Oh, that's very kind. Just me. I'm gonna come across like a degenerate up here, you know. Everything. Oh well, thank you. I will enjoy the clean water in this Pams here.
You know where Hams is from?
Hams?
Yeah.
Where is it from?
The land of sky blue waters.
What'd you say?
The land of sky blue waters.
The land of sky blue. Oh, Minnesota. Yeah. Now you're from Minnesota, right?
From Wisconsin.
Oh, you're from Wisconsin.
Fox Valley.
Okay, you're from the Fox Valley. Really good. Yeah. Now Minnesota, though, I mean, when we're talking about water, that's the land of 10,000 lakes.
Yeah, this is true. They have 10,000 lakes in Minnesota. We have more lakes here in Wisconsin.
We can get a round of applause for that.
If you go
how many lakes do we have, Jake?
If you go to Wikipedia or you ask the Wisconsin DNR, the official count is 15,074 lakes.
Does so that count manure lagoons?
It does not. It does not. Yeah. So I think we have a. I mean, but the point here is that we have an incredible number of lakes, an incredible diversity of lakes, and lakes are absolutely part of what make Wisconsin Wisconsin. They're part of our culture. They're part of our well-being, and they affect every one of us. So we are here right now, each and every one of us, because of Lake Mendota. I mean, we wouldn't be here if there was no lake there.
It'd be as boring as Ann Arbor, you know, if that lake wasn't here.
Imagine this is a cornfield.
Michigan. What's that?
Imagine this was a cornfield.
Oh,
I mean, this would not. We would not be here right now.
It'd be a different vibe. It would be a different vibe. But I guess my point in bringing this up, and we were talking earlier in the back room over there, but if you look at the Wisconsin license plate, you kind of have this image, and Dan, you brought it up. You want to go into that, or you want me to take your bit?
Well, I'll just mention, yeah, I was thinking about it driving over here the other day. The license plate, it's got a barn on it on one end, and it's got a sailboat on the other. These are two things that define this great state, and they should not be working at cross purposes. And too often right now, sometimes they are. And I think everybody values what's on the right side of the plate, the farms. Everybody eats. I had lunch today. I'll have dinner tonight. But everybody also needs water. And, you know, there's no reason why we can't have both. And when I say needs water, this isn't an abstract threat. In 2014, about a decade ago, the city of Toledo got a plume of this toxic algae sucked into its drinking water system, and they lost their water for like 4 or 5 days, and they couldn't boil it. It wasn't like, oh, just boil your water and we'll get this back online. If you boiled it, it would concentrate the toxins. So you had the National Guard bringing in pallets of baby formula and tankers of water and stores as close as like Ann Arbor, which is like an hour away. Within the first 3 or 4 hours, we're out of bottled water. And so there they are in Toledo on the banks of the world's grandest freshwater system. It holds 20% of the world's fresh surface water, and you couldn't even drink it with treatment. And that's the sign that something's broken and we haven't fixed it yet.
Civic Media radio stations providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
CBS News Brief, a half a century after America's war in Vietnam, an American president speaks there calling for closer ties.
What it will allow them to do is more business. There are also talks of perhaps even more exchange of military arms deals, for instance, and perhaps including Vietnam in the semiconductor supply chain.
The BBC's Laura Bicker in Hanoi. While in Asia, Mr. Biden's also keeping an eye on North Africa on the rescue efforts after a major weekend earthquake in Morocco. The death toll there now over 2,000 and still increasing.
We're working expeditiously to ensure American citizens in Morocco are safe, standing ready to provide any necessary assistance to the Moroccan people.
Back here, Hurricane Lee is now a lessening weather concern in the Atlantic. CBS News forecaster David Parkinson.
It looks like the best case scenario is playing out, which is that Lee stays far offshore.
But it is still expected to send some strong waves and currents to the shore. CBS News Brief, I'm Tom Foti.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio each month for news, weather, and emergency information. A new bill in Congress would make sure AM radio remains in cars. Because when cell and internet services are down, this free service could be your only lifeline. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress to support the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act.
Message and data rates may apply. You may receive up to 4 messages a month, and you may text STOP to STOP.
This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
If I could be you.
And you could be me.
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way.
To get inside.
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe. And is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
UPS Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
93.5, The Tap.
Hey, folks, you are listening to the Cripescast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media.
Now, Dan, I've had you on the Cripescast before, and you've kind of made it clear that you don't really consider yourself an environmentalist. You consider yourself an environmental journalist, where you are kind of laying out the issues that affect us. But as far as solutions go, that's not exactly what you're trying to find here. You're more laying out. And by the way, you do a great job of making phosphorus interesting. I got to give you that, you know.
Thank you very much. I think that's the best compliment I've ever heard.
Starts the book off with a police chase, you know. It don't get any more fun than that.
Yeah, but, go ahead.
Oh, no. You.
Well, yeah, I don't try to be prescriptive in this book saying we need to do this, this, and that. But there are some obvious things that need to be addressed. And I think number one is what Jake was talking about. The Clean Water Act in 1972 went after factories and industries and left alone farming. At the time, farming was more, you know, it's exactly what Randy was talking about. It was cows eating grass. And this gets back to this phosphorus loop that we were talking about, or the trickle of phosphorus into the world. If you think about a farm, you got pasture, a cow eats the grass, poops. That grows more grass, the cow eats it, poops, and it's a cycle, and it goes over and over and over.
That's what Mufasa was talking about, in the circle of life.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've watched The Lion King. Sorry, I digress.
We turned it into a straight line, and that line runs into that water.
I really screwed you up by throwing that Mufasa reference in there. What's in the shadowy place, Dan? You must never go there.
Can I just riff on something Dan said?
Yeah, please.
Our license plate has the sailboat on one end, the barn on the other end. We all value the sailboat and the water that it's on. We all value the farming, the barns, et cetera. And yet, here's our crown jewel behind us. And it is slowly but surely, we're titrating in, we're trickling in phosphorus in ways that are making it, you know, unusable eventually. And on the other side of the license plate are barns that we value and love. And when we think about Wisconsin, it's very iconic. And yet Wisconsin is losing 2 farms a day for the last 30 years. And we're on a trajectory to have 5 farms by the year 2037, if we play out the last 30 years of farm loss. And in the meantime, we're making more and more milk. Our dairy science department is amazingly productive. They've done amazing work. And they've done what we've asked them to do, which is to figure out how to make more milk. But it's coming at a huge expense to the environment. And none of us can afford to say, I'm not an environmentalist. Sorry, Dan. We're all environmentalists. It's about our health and it's about our well-being.
Well, maybe I put those words into his mouth. But yeah, you can give that a round of applause. It is about all our health. And I also, in sort of preparing to do this, I was talking to a couple of buddies of mine who are farmers, and they're kind of, bringing up this issue to them, and they were kind of saying they are personally, and I can't speak for the entire industry, but they're saying that they do have regulations. There are a lot of steps in place to limit this. They are doing a better job to do it. They're not doing it when the ground is frozen over. They're not doing it close to rain. They're not putting it on hillsides, putting it far away from the water. And also, the profitability for at least my buddies, they're not making a ton of money. And so I wonder, is the system in play not set up for them to succeed all the time?
Well, no, it's not. It's set up for them to extract as much as they can out of the system and push that forward to the corporations, sadly. The things that they're doing, which are really laudable, cover crops, no-till, spreading manure only at certain times of the year, et cetera, those are all great things, important things, but they are not going to fix the problem that we have here. The problem is immense. So we've had a grad student, Tracy Campbell, who works with Chris Kucharik in our department, published a paper recently that showed in order for this lake to get clean, in order for it to meet EPA standards, we need half as many cows in the watershed, half of the ag land in perennial grass, and it has to be like that for 50 years. And in the year 2070, we'll actually meet our goal. The problem is immense. It is not going to get fixed by a little bit of this here and a little bit of that there. And so that's why we're all about like trying to change the overall system and not just tweak it here and there to keep the same system in place.
How would you recommend, and I know you touched on this before, but how would you recommend changing the system? And for farmers out there, how would that impact their bottom line?
Farmers.
I love when I ask a question, you're like, I'm not answering that. He's the farm guy.
I know I'm waving my arms and pontificating here, but it's an exciting topic for me. Well, we have to come together as a society and reward farmers for doing this. That's the first thing. We have to bring farmers and other folks in the community together, and this is what we're trying to do in this Grassland 2.0 project, and be intentional about what it is we want and need out of the land and what it is we want and need out of our communities, et cetera, what we want and need out of the water, and start to map and plan how we get there. And that's something that we're not doing right now. It's just sort of happening willy-nilly. The system just happens. And I think the system only changes when we come together as a community and embrace the idea of collective action. You know, this is how a lot of big things have happened in the world. Civil rights is an example of this. People come together in communities and engage in collective action so that the powers actually have to listen.
Okay, well, let's say this group of people here. Yeah, give him a... I keep stepping on your applause, you know. Let's say this group of people here wanted to collectively come to a solution tomorrow and go, you know, participate in the democratic process of lobbying and all that sort of jazz. What would we even say we want, though?
Can I say something?
Yeah, go on.
I was just going to say, if we're talking about this lake in particular, science can guide that. And again, this isn't for changing the system per se. This is just changing this system right here, Lake Mendota. So studies done at the Center for Limnology revealed that if we can reduce the amount of phosphorus coming into the lake by about half, so right now it's 110,000 pounds of phosphorus washing in per year. If we could bring that down to about 50, we would have really darn good water quality. So those studies have been done. And then the question is, how do we reduce that phosphorus coming in? And that's where we get to agriculture, system changes, grasslands, and things like that. There have been a lot of practices like the ones that Randy mentioned, cover crops, riparian buffer strips, and so on, that have been implemented in farms that are upstream of Lake Mendota that drain in. Millions of dollars have been put into this. Farmers are participating in these programs. What we've seen is the total amount of phosphorus coming into the lake has actually increased over the time that these practices were being implemented. And the reason why is climate change. We're getting more rain washing off the land, and we're getting more large rain events, and we've lost wetlands as well. So even though millions of dollars have been spent on this problem, we've actually seen increases in the amount of phosphorus coming in. So we have headwinds. People are working really hard to address these issues, and yet it seems like we're on a treadmill and we're not getting anywhere. But stuff is being done.
So we don't have to do anything then?
We need to keep working, and we need to be patient and recognize that it's like raising children, right? You don't see the benefits. My kids are right over there. You don't see the benefits of it tomorrow or the next day. You just keep plugging away at it, and the benefits are going to be long-term, hopefully.
Is that a promise?
Yeah.
Okay. My daughter's right over there. I would have a suggestion too, and that would be looking beyond the lake, this lake in particular, looking at this thing nationally, ethanol. 40% of the corn we grow in this country goes into our gas tanks. 40%.
It's a lot of gas.
it's a lot of food. You know, for the amount of acres that we're growing ethanol corn with, we could feed half the country with grains and vegetables. And so this is a kind of a no-win situation, except for the people who financially profit from it. And it seems like an intractable problem, but a sweep of a pen could fix this. And, you know, we're heading toward electricity anyway. I mean, electric vehicles. You look at the acreage being used in Iowa, there's been some studies where they'd be way better off planting solar panels. You can actually grow stuff underneath the solar panels as well. You get double bang for your buck. But, you know, it seems like an intractable problem, but there are certain things that we could do now, and that would be take another look at ethanol and also take a look at this exemption in the Clean Water Act for agriculture and for what goes on the landscape. It needs to be measured and controlled until there are actual, you know, more than incentives, but consequences. I don't see things getting better very quickly.
When it comes to ethanol, why is ethanol? Because, you know, you kind of... it's one of those weird issues that has both bipartisan support, but then also when you talk to people on both sides of the political aisle, you know, my uncle doesn't like putting in his gas tank, you know, and he's pretty far on the right. And then, you know, my hippie friends don't think it's good for the environment. It's not solving the climate issue at all. And so when you kind of have that dichotomy a little bit, why is that the case, Dan?
It's politics. And it's specifically, I mean, you could trace it back and make the argument that it's politics in Iowa, because that's where corn is king and ethanol is king as well. And that's where politicians come out of the gate. If they want to be president, they have to basically go to Iowa, specifically to the Iowa State Fair, where they stand on a stage smaller than this and tell the Iowa voters what they want to hear. And they all want to hear that they support ethanol. And this, you know, the Democrats have pulled out of Iowa as their first caucus or first on the primary season. The Republicans are still there. And you're not going to win Iowa unless you do show your faith to this whole institution of ethanol. I went over to Iowa in 2019 to the state fair, and I tried to get Joe Biden's attention on the little soapbox. There were only about 50 of us there, but he wouldn't call on me. I followed him into the bathroom afterwards.
Wow. And that's a real journalist, folks, yeah. You know?
And
now you're on a lot of lists.
I got this on tape. Yeah. my little run-in with him. He comes out and his hand's still wet, and he puts it on my shoulder. And I asked
him. No towels in there. He had to wipe it off somehow.
So, you know, I asked him, do you support ethanol? And he just looked me straight in the eye and said, yeah. And then the next day, Elizabeth Warren said the same thing. So it's not a Republican-Democrat thing. It's just built into the system, and we're all suffering because of it.
Well, you pushed, in your book, you pushed Joe Biden on it a little bit, saying, I believe I remember this correctly, saying that the environmental benefits of it were not really there. What did he say to that?
Well, he started talking about the holy grail of biofuels, and that's using the corn stalk, not the kernels. They call it cellulosic, and they keep saying that it's about to happen, and it's not happening. And so that gives everybody cover to say, let us just put corn in our cars until we can figure out how to put corn stalks in our cars. We don't need that.
Yeah, Randy, why is that the case that we're only using the kernel, not the whole stalk? Because that could, and if we could use the whole stalk, like if ethanol at its best, we the technology progressed and we could use everything, would it be a good thing, a net win for the environment?
Absolutely, it would be a huge win for the environment. It not only can we do it now, we have to do it. And
why aren't we?
We have the technology to do it. The reason we don't do it are these policies that subsidize the first generation ethanol, which is to say the ethanol that comes from the corn grain. And so if you can make ethanol out of a corn stalk, you can make it out of a switchgrass plant, you can make it out of a diverse prairie, you can make it out of any plant biomass. And we can do that now. It's cost effective now, especially if you take the subsidies that go to the first generation ethanol and put them at the second generation. But there are powers that be that don't want that to happen, just like the last story I told.
Well, what are the powers that be that are coming between it?
The corporations that make money from the current situation where the first generation ethanol gets produced and these ethanol plants that are built all across the country. And look, again, this is rational actors. These are not nefarious people trying to undermine the planet. They're trying to do what they're supposed to do, which is make money for their shareholders.
And which corporations are these? I'm trying to get you to name names up here, Andy. You know, I'm really trying to throw you under the bus.
I don't know who they are. I'm just an ecologist, Charlie.
All right. You guys can Google it. And it's definitely not Monsanto. Okay.
It's not just Monsanto for sure, but it's one of the.
No, but and again, to your point, they are just playing within. It was like Trump when he sat up there on the debate stage and they were talking about how he didn't pay taxes. And he was like, why? Because I'm smart. Well, that's the system we set up in play. And he wasn't completely wrong. We don't have a system that rewards the moral thing to do. We have a system that rewards shareholders maximizing their profits. That sort of goes back to the stock market. The stock market doesn't care about years from now. It cares about tomorrow. And this isn't an anti-capitalist thing by any stretch of the imagination. I just think capitalism would work better if we thought, I mean, the cost of water is insane. And we're going to be paying billions of dollars to clean up something that we only made millions of dollars from. I'm sorry, we're going to spend trillions of dollars clean up something we paid billions of dollars for. It would have been cool if I didn't try to correct myself. I got a nice like applause there. You guys get what I'm saying, though. At the end of the day, just thinking about these systems in whole. So let me ask you this. Now, you have a lot of hardworking farmers out there in Iowa, and they've got corn because that's what they've had traditionally, historically. What would an ideal system look like that they would be growing? I know you said grasslands, but kind of specific, and why is that so much better than corn?
Well, we do agriculture in grasslands. You know, when we look around the world, there are really three main biomes: forest, grassland, and desert. And most of our agriculture is in grassland, in the grassland biome. I don't think it's an overstatement to say that where we do agriculture, we've torn up that grassland and cracked open all the energy that's stored in the soil there. And so what I mean by grassland 2.0 is that we have to have agriculture that actually starts to put that energy back into the soil, which is all about taking a little bit less out of the system, harvesting a little bit less, putting back a little bit more so that the system actually accrues energy rather than loses energy. And that's putting grasslands back in place. It's restoring grasslands, perennial grasslands that used to be here. And I don't mean like it has to be wall-to-wall tall grass prairie with butterflies and birds and bees. Oh yeah, they'll be there if we put the grassland back. It can be grazed pastures. It can be pastures for second generation ethanol. It can be all kinds of uses of that grass. And there's a lot of work that has to go into figuring out how to do that well, but we've got to restore that ecosystem. We've got to restore its function so that it holds on to nutrients, holds on to carbon, and takes care of us.
So this all seems like a pretty logical thing to do. So is there a whole lot on the political side of this? And maybe, Dan, this might be something you can discuss. What like from a political standpoint, if we explain this, or if any politician were sitting in this audience, I have a hard time thinking that they would see a different way. What is sort of standing in the way? Is it just the way systems have been done?
Yeah, I think we're just kind of become slaves to the system. We don't think about it. We don't think about the fact that we've just basically built a whole agriculture economy on use your fertilizer once and flush it away. It's got to be restored, and it's connecting dots. It's letting people realize that, you know, you bring your grandkid down here to take a dip off the dock and they can't go in. Well, how did that happen? And it comes back to the way we've engineered our food system. And, you know, Wisconsin's got a great history of cutting edge, you know, breaking ground agriculture techniques. And I was just pulling my phone out here because I was thinking about just up the hill is building F.H. King. And is that the soil sciences building? And his name is Franklin King, I believe. Anyway, F.H. Was a professor here, and he went over to Asia in 1908, 1909 to try to figure out how these guys were still alive. Because we'd only been, you know, farming the Great Plains for a matter of decades, and we were burning them up, even with the burgeoning nascent chemical fertilizer industry. And he went over there and he wrote a book called Farmers of 40 Centuries, which is 4,000 years. And he was trying to get to the bottom of how do these guys keep farming the same land year after year after year and getting the same kind of productivity? And the answer was thrift and recognizing the circular nature of life, of the Lion King, as you mentioned.
It's the circle of life.
Sorry, I won't sing
this,
again.
This just blew me away. He went to one farm and he saw this kid. This was in Korea, I think. Saw a kid following a cow around with a dipper. And the cow was going around and around because it was powering a well that was drawing water to grow rice. The kid was following the cow because he was catching the poop coming out of his butt and putting it into some sort of a vessel. And it was being returned to the land. And when he saw it, he wrote, there came a flash of resentment that such a task for the lad, that there was such a task for the lad, for we were only beginning to realize what lengths the practice of economy may go. But there was nothing irksome suggested in the boy's face. He performed the duty as a matter of course. And as we thought about it, there was no reason why it should be otherwise. In fact, the only right course was being taken. Conditions have been worse if collection wasn't being made. It made possible more rice. Character and substantial quality was building in the lad, which meant thrift in the growing man and continued life for a nation. They recognize the phosphorus loop, and we don't. And it's not really that hard to get once you start thinking about it. We can't just use it once and flush it in the water.
That's very well said. Also, that image of him, I'm like, what is he putting it in? You know, that was where my mind went, but I'm an idiot. Jake, I can't remember if you said this, but how many days out here, to Dan's point about not realizing this loop, how many days is it safe to swim in this lake?
Well, it varies a lot from year to year, but there's a decent number of days every, I can't give you the exact number.
Don't let biased algorithms or degree screens or exclusive professional networks or stereotypes, don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight.
The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.